This is Infants on Thrones.
Minisode.
Hi, I'm Brother Jake, and today I'd like to share a story from when I was a missionary. Honestly, I don't think that anything about Mormonism will ever be quite as interesting to me as the subculture of missionary service. Now, all of you probably know the basics of missionary life. Every exchange, which is a period of 6 weeks, you're assigned to a companion who you have to spend every waking hour with as you go out and teach and preach and work as missionaries do. And with a few exceptions, you're either assigned to that companionship as a junior or senior companion, which distinguishes who has the final word of authority between the two. But missionary leadership hierarchy is a huge part of the missionary service, and the junior-senior companion thing only scratches the surface. There are trainers who are assigned to the missionary straight out of the MTC to mentor the newbies, district leaders who preside over groups of 3 to 5 companionships, zone leaders who preside over groups of 3 to 5 districts, and finally the APs, the assistants to the president, who have influence over leadership assignments, area placement, molding mission-wide initiatives, you name it. Each position is filled by somebody hand-chosen by the mission president or the AP specifically for that role. And since missions receive new missionaries and send ones that have finished their 2 years home every exchange, every 6 weeks new leadership positions would open up and a group of elders could move up the leadership structure. And make no mistake, these lines of authority weren't any kind of weak sauce, abstract distinctions in name only. Missionaries are Mormons, after all, so obsessing over and deifying leadership positions runs bone deep. The reminders of where you fit in the pecking order are everywhere, from leader-initiated work visits, to unannounced pop-ins from higher-ups to check if you've done your companionship study that morning, to the weekly ritual of reporting key performance metrics,
13 lessons taught without a member,
5 lessons taught with a member present,
4 investigators that attended
2
church,
investigators with a baptismal,
1
date,
investigator baptized,
1 investigator confirmed,
as well as your goals for those metrics for the upcoming week up the chain of command, from the regular companionships to the district leader who reports the district totals to the zone leader who reports the zone totals to the APs who report the mission totals to the president who puts the highest and most inspiring of those numbers and names of the associated companionship in the weekly mission newsletter to show us all what missionaries with real faith can do. I should interject here and say if this whole thing is starting to seem a little male-centric, it's because it is, and I'm gonna kind of just blame that on the missionary system. In fact, I don't think there's another place in the church where women are more systematically marginalized than in missionary service, but that's another topic for another day. What I'm trying to say here is that I'm sorry there isn't more of a female presence in this story, but to be fair, there wasn't much of a female presence in this period of my life, if you know what I mean. Anyway, I hope it can still be interesting. My point is that this whole leadership reporting structure created an unspoken understanding that all missionaries came to, which is that your success was almost entirely defined by 2 things, your numbers and your leadership position. And as much as I hate to admit it, I really bought into this idea, because like any other wide-eyed, true blue Mormon boy, I wanted to be a successful missionary. Now, a lot of that drive came from reasons you might imagine. I loved God, I had a strong personal conviction of the church, and I wanted to prove myself within my faith to my friends and family so I could score that celestial hottie when the time came. But to be honest, there was more to it than that. See, when I was 9, my dad died suddenly from a stroke. And as I grew up, over time, the already small reservoir of memories I had of him slowly dried up, so I started to create this image of him in my mind. And since the way I did that was asking my mom every few months if I could carefully leaf through the pages out of his journals from when he served first as a missionary and later as a mission president, I associated my mental image of him most strongly with missionary work. By the time I finally turned 19, I saw my mission as a way to reconnect with him in a way that I wasn't able to before, and the more successful I was, the more connected to him I'd feel. So it was with these complicated set of emotions and motivations that I took to the mission field, ready to light the hearts of Peruvians everywhere ablaze with the fire of my testimony. And for the first several months, it went pretty well. Sure, there were always struggles and setbacks, but overall, things were looking up. My numbers were good, not great, but good. My Spanish was pretty impressive, and I'd risen quickly in the ranks from junior companion to senior companion to district leader. And as I was coming up on my 3rd exchange as a DL, there's a little inside acronym for you, things seemed to be lining up. I was good friends with both of the APs, and one of my zone leaders was going home, so I had a really good shot at moving into the position. All I had to do was perform well that exchange, and I'd be good to go. That's when I met my new companion, Elder Roldan. Now, I wouldn't say that I had a great relationship with all my missionary companions, but I'd never had one look me in the eye and say calmly and with total frankness, "I hate you. I hate everything about you." The thing is, I bet we would have been great friends in any other situation. He was funny, smart, savvy, and just a little cynical. But the pressure I was under from my own paternal reconnection thing and the general idea that I was responsible to God for people's most intimate personal decisions exposed my insecurities like a raw nerve. And his ability to see right through all my pious bullshit and point it out without reservation chafed me constantly. So I reacted, poorly. Whenever I'd feel like he damaged my ego, I'd do something punitive to reassert my dominance in the companionship. Nothing drastic, mind you. It wasn't like I'd break out the whip and ball gag. Just little things, like talk down to him in front of people, or knock on a door, or wait for someone to open, and then just stare at him silently until he finally broke down and did the door approach, or kneel down for prayers that we didn't typically kneel down for so he'd look like, I don't know, not spiritual or something. But those things added up, and if I'm being totally honest with myself, I'd say that what I did would be best described as emotional abuse. So I'm sure you won't be surprised that it fell apart. One P-Day, we were getting ready for our weekly session at the Internet Cafe when I decided that we were going to do a bit of companionship scripture study, probably as some sort of stupid way of getting back at him for pointing out that I was a jackass. He wasn't fond of the idea, and he stood up to go to the other room, and for some reason I decided that I wasn't going to let that happen, and got in front of him asking him what was going on like I had no idea. I don't know why exactly, but that was the last straw. He pushed me away and gave me a quick right hook to my jaw. For a split second, I considered punching back, but I remember the only time I ever tried to punch another person in the face. It was my freshman year of high school, and my body language had been so obvious that the guy sidestepped me and I missed completely. You know the part in Spider-Man where the bully tries to punch Tobey Maguire in school after he gets his Spidey powers? It was like that. Anyway, so punching was out. However, I had been a wrestler in high school, so I went with what I knew. I stepped into his body and swung around behind him and locked my hands around his waist. But when I went to throw him to the ground, my foot slipped on a piece of paper and he wriggled free enough to land a second punch near my left temple. I lunged for his legs and slammed him to the ground, pinning him underneath me. He shouted, "I'm done! I'm done!" And for the first time, I noticed the blood dripping from the small cut just beneath my left eyebrow. I called the zone leaders and wheels were put in motion to fix our situation, but in the meantime, my cut just wouldn't stop bleeding. And while I looked around the apartment for a remedy that wouldn't involve me getting stitches, I learned a few valuable lessons. Like, for example, while it is true that superglue can be used to close minor lesions effectively, you should probably A, not self-apply it, B, only apply to areas that have been cleared of hair, and C, not apply near a sensitive organ like, say, an eyeball. Long story short, the fumes blinded me for like 5 minutes, and by the time I unstuck my fingers from my face, a chunk of my eyebrow was missing and I had ripped the cut open to double its size. Now, as memorable as that experience was, the part of it that stands out most to me wasn't the sadness I felt when I had to leave the area without being able to say goodbye to the friends I'd made, or being stuck totally alone in the Lima airport overnight, or the way my mission president never really treated me the same way again. It was the moment right after I slammed this poor kid that I'd been shitting on emotionally for weeks to the ground and he shouted for me to stop. Because in that instant, the most incredible wave of calm and relief I've ever felt in my life poured over me. A moment of pure serenity. I've wondered why that was for a long time, and I think it really comes down to one word: insecurity. To me, the key component of insecurity is uncertainty. Uncertainty about what people think, or what you should do, or who you should be. And up to that point, combating insecurity had been a major driving force in my life. It was one of the major reasons I got on a mission in the first place, to prove myself to God and my church and my family. It was the reason I put so much pressure on myself as a missionary. Yes, I had been given the authority of God, but the only way I could be absolutely sure I could attain the numerical results the mission president expected was to purge the unclean vessel, myself. It was the reason I wanted to be a zone leader, and the reason I was a dick to Elder Roldan, and even the reason I tried to superglue my own head wound shut. My life was plagued by insecurity, and I spent every waking moment running away from it. But in that moment, pinning my companion to the ground while blood dripped from my face, I felt strangely at peace. Because after that dam of tension broke, there was no ambiguity or hidden feelings or unspoken resentment. For the first time since we met, Elder Roldan and I were acting not as missionaries, but simply as ourselves. It was just me and him, raw, unfiltered. You see, up to that point in my mission, everything I had done and said had been completely shaped by the concept of being a missionary and all the personal and institutional baggage and expectations that that carried. And all the uncertainty I had felt from not quite living up to those expectations had been slowly distorting my self-image and poisoning all my relationships. It wasn't until I pushed myself so far outside the range of behavior that was expected or even acceptable for a missionary that I broke through the caricature of myself that I had created and tasted a glimpse, however brief, of living my life on my own terms, and it felt fantastic. Now, I'm not saying that everyone can or even should leave a life free of insecurity. Some uncertainty is inevitable, and I suppose insecurity can be a useful motivator in some cases. And I'm also not saying that how things played out for me on my mission was good or right. It wasn't. But one of the things about the church and Mormon theology that I hate the most is that it institutionalizes insecurity in a manipulative way. It takes the relationships that should be untouchable and consistent, the relationship between a person and their creator or their family, and puts all these conditions on it. It manufactures a feeling of inadequacy, which creates uncertainty about one standing before God, which in turn generates a feeling of insecurity and a dependent relationship on the church for all the good things you want. Not that people in the church do that deliberately with some nefarious purpose, it's just a natural outgrowth of the obsession with ordinances and elitist one true church idea that runs through Mormonism. What I'm getting at is this: don't live your life running from insecurities, trying to fill some unquantifiable gap between what you are and what you're supposed to be according to someone else's standards of excellence is a rat race. It will erode your self-confidence, hamstring your autonomy, and warp your self-image. It's a shit motivation for making life decisions, and you shouldn't do it. Anyway, that's all I got. Anyone for the closing prayer?